Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. This is the podcast of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. I'm your host, Sam Wong. I'm a professor of neuroscience and director of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. My co-host Julian is off gadding about. He is either coming back to or going from Princeton at the moment, and he'll be back next week. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce our guest for today, Alec Karakatsanis. Alec Karakatsanis is founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he was a Supreme Court chair of the Harvard Law Review. Early in his career, he developed an interest in injustices in our criminal legal system, and that's what we'll mainly be talking about today. Alec co-founded the nonprofit organization Equal Justice Under Law, which is dedicated to systemic litigation challenging injustices in our criminal legal system. He served as a civil rights lawyer and public defender with the Special Litigation Division of the Public Defender Service for D.C., and as a federal public defender in Alabama representing impoverished people accused of federal crimes. He was named 2016 Trial Lawyer of the Year by Public Justice. Currently, Alec is founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, a nonprofit dedicated to groundbreaking systemic litigation and advocacy challenging pervasive injustices in our criminal legal system. Today, we will talk about a variety of topics. We're going to talk about cash bail system and his efforts to end it, and other topics having to do with the rights of people who are incarcerated or caught up in the legal system. Alec, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
So let's see. So let's first talk about like why you're here on campus. You're visiting the school as part of a leadership through mentorship program. Tell me about the kinds of things you're doing while you're on campus these few days.
I'll be meeting with a lot of students, talking a little bit about the work that I'm doing, the work that they're interested in doing, how they might think about their careers as they embark on the really serious moral questions involved, and what do I do with this education I'm getting with all the energy that I have that animates my body each day, and how can I reduce some of the enormous suffering that our legal system and our society generally are inflicting every single day. And so I'm talking a lot about the urgent issues that we're working on and hopefully trying to inspire some of them to engage with these issues in a really significant way when they graduate. And I'll also be giving a public lecture on the bureaucracy of mass human caging, talking a little bit about the work that we're doing around the country to dismantle the system of human caging and the bureaucracy that's attached to it all over the country as we have achieved rates of incarceration unprecedented in the recorded history of the modern world in this country.
Now, I just have to pause on that. I just found that phrase, mass human caging system, I just find that frightening. Can we just talk a little bit about the degree of imprisonment and what you mean by mass human caging?
Yeah, when a lot of people refer to our legal system as the, quote, criminal justice system, end quote. And for me, I don't like to use that phrase because I don't want to give people the impression that the system's purpose or effect is to do any kind of justice. Throughout the history of this country, the criminal punishment system has been used as a tool of white supremacy, of capitalism, of preserving inequality, of controlling certain communities. And so for me, I like to try to use language that's much more accurately describing what we're doing. And what we're doing in this country every single year is putting metal chains on 12 million people and arresting them, feeding them into this giant bureaucracy, at the outcome of which is putting them into cages. And those cages are places that we've allowed to become grotesque torture chambers in many cases. So our clients are sleeping all over each other on the floors in the middle of feces and blood and mold and mucus. They are getting inadequate medical care. Many of them are in solitary confinement without any contact with any other human beings. They're given infectious diseases. They're physically and sexually assaulted. They are deprived of the chance to hug or speak to or have any interaction with their children and their families. And so the things that we're doing to people and to their bodies are very urgent. And I think some of the language that the system typically uses is an effort to sanitize what we're doing and to desensitize people to the brutality that we're inflicting. And so one of the things that we do in our cases all over the country is we try to change the narrative around what the criminal punishment system is doing to families and to people and to communities. And so we try to use different words. It may sound silly, but it's one of the ways in which we push back and try to push back against the normalization of a lot of this brutality is through little things like the way we talk about it.
So if we think about why people are imprisoned who are found guilty of crimes in a court, I would characterize there being as two major categories of thinking about why people are locked up after being found guilty. One would be rehabilitation, and that is a claim of being put in jail. And the other is retribution, where someone did something and as a society we're angry at that person and we want them to go to jail because they deserve it. So to what extent Is there any system anywhere in the country or any element of actual rehabilitation? And by rehabilitation, I mean I'm including in that things that make the person a better person. And I recognize that you've just described an extremely different view of it, but I just want to explore that a little bit because that's what a lot of people think prison is for.
Yeah, I would add that the traditional – there's a third traditional justification for punishment, deterrence, that a lot of legal scholars point to, which is it's not just that we're trying to rehabilitate that person or punish that person. We're actually trying to deter other people from committing crimes. And one of the functions of punishment is to deter. I think all three of these traditional punishments have virtually no connection to the current modern American legal punishment system, particularly rehabilitation, which you've asked about. We are not serious in any meaningful way about addressing the largely social and public health problems that lead people to commit crimes. And we're not interested really in creating a world in which the various deprivations, whether they be related to poverty or mental health or drug addiction, we're not really interested in remedying those. Our prisons and jails have been completely divested of meaningful programs that actually help people keep the connection that they need to their families, that help them prepare for work and shelter and health care when they get out. By and large, our jail and prison system is a place where people leave the system far more traumatized, far less healthy, far less connected to their family and friends, and far less able to find employment when they get out. And so if your concern is rehabilitation, our legal system is operating in a way that is entirely inconsistent with that general value.
Well, it sounds like it's achieving the retribution aspect pretty well.
Yeah, if one views the purpose of punishment as inflicting enormous pain on someone without any concern for whether that pain has any productive use for the rest of society, then yes, our legal system is functioning very well as an instrument of pain. And I might add, it's not just punishing the individual people who may have, I don't know, been put in a cage for years for possessing a plant that's on a list of plants that they're not permitted to possess, or they may have been put in a cage for inflicting some kind of physical harm on another human being. But we're not just inflicting pain on them. We're also inflicting enormous pain on their loved ones. We have a situation in this country where people who have done something that we consider to be a crime, at least people who have been policed and caught for that crime, because we have enormous lawlessness throughout our society, which we can talk about in a little bit, where police are really not looking at the crimes of many wealthier and white people. But if you think about the pain that we're inflicting on that person, largely ignored is the pain we're inflicting on their family, because in most places, people are not permitted to have any contact with their families when they're put into jail and prison. We have privatized the prison visitation industry. And so most local jails and prisons now don't even permit contact visits with your family. If you can afford it and pay enough money, which many prisoners cannot, you're permitted to call through Skype or video system at exorbitant rates, talk to your loved ones. And so we've monetized human contact in a way that's both detrimental to rehabilitation and that causes a lot of emotional pain to families and separates them.
How much of this is a result of privatizing of prisons themselves? Does this happen in publicly operated prisons as well? Can you give us a picture of that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of discussion around the country about private prisons, although private prisons are really only about 7 or 8% of the state prison system. They're over 50% of the federal immigration detention network, but they're a relatively small percentage of state prison systems. The far greater problem is the privatization of virtually every aspect of public prisons. So if you look at most of the public prisons in this country that are run by government entities, virtually every aspect inside of them has been privatized. The as I mentioned, the phone service, multi-billion dollar a year industry now, charging exorbitant rates to people and their families who want to call home. I mentioned the video calling industry. There's the commissary industry. So they provide such terrible food and soap and toiletries. In some places, it's really non-existent. If you want any semblance of normal hygiene or nutritious food, you have to pay exorbitant rates to the private food commissary industry in public prisons. The medical care in prisons has been privatized. The prison system also is a huge labor pool for large private corporations. So their labor is coerced at rates, you know, sometimes a dollar a day, 50 cents a day, $2 a day, making products for the government and for large multinational corporations. If you look at virtually every single aspect of the prison life, including the programming that's now offered in prisons, such as it is, all of that, or much of that, has been privatized. And so those industries altogether add up to a much larger total sort of economic output than the private prison industry itself.
What kind of people tell? Let's hear a little bit about the kind of stories that people have coming into this, because there seem to be a variety of ways that people can end up in a situation where they're imprisoned like this. So can we talk a little bit about the range of offenses that gets a person into this situation?
Sure. I think one very important thing to understand is the vast majority of arrests in this country every single year are for low-level so-called nonviolent offenses. So in many jurisdictions that I work in, the most commonly charged offense is driving on a suspended license. And this country has over 7 million driver's licenses that have been suspended, not for any kind of driving-related activity, but solely because people are too poor to pay their court debts. We just won a case in Tennessee, for example, that got back hundreds of thousands of driver's licenses for impoverished people in Tennessee whose licenses were taken away just because they were poor. And we're doing that so frequently. California, until a couple of years ago, had suspended 4.2 million driver's licenses just in California. We're doing it so frequently that we've really altered daily life for impoverished people. And in many places in the country, you can't go to the grocery store or see your family or go to church or go to a job because you don't have a license. And so what people do is they end up driving because it's a necessity of life. And they get pulled over, they get arrested, they get jailed, they get given more court debt because they can't afford the fees and the fines and the court costs. It's this vicious cycle. The next sort of largest category of offenses in many jurisdictions that I work is minor drug possession cases. In this country, we arrest and jail more people every year for marijuana possession than all violent crime combined. So it's very important that people understand, and there's been some really great recent work by several people. I want to lift up the work of Professor Alexandra Natapoff, who's written quite extensively on the ways in which...
Spell that?
Alexandra, A-L-E-X-A-N-D-R-A, yeah. Natapoff, N-A-T-A-P-O-F-F. Mm-hmm. And Professor Natapoff has written about how the misdemeanor system has really driven a lot of the expansion in mass incarceration. And it has all kinds of effects for policing, because policing can use the mass processing of misdemeanor cases to collect money and property through civil forfeiture, can use the volume of arrests to get federal grant money, to get overtime pay for police officers. And there's all these incentives that police have to pursue large volumes of low-level arrests. And you can see that all over the country, with many, many police departments having a backlog of tens of thousands of untested rape kits, so rapes and sexual assaults that they're not even investigating because they're devoting their resources to low-level policing. So one important point to answer your question that I think we just can't ignore is that the vast bulk of the current American punishment system is the mass processing of low-level nonviolent criminal offenses.
And so what did you think of the I guess it was a recent Supreme Court case about the excessiveness of financial penalties, the asset seizure. I've forgotten the name of the case, but, you know, it's just in the news in the last week or so. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that seems relevant to this.
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's called Timms versus Indiana. The case is largely insignificant as a matter of legal doctrine. All it says is that the excessive fines clause applies to the states. That was a relatively uncontroversial legal question. Almost everybody already thought that it did. The case doesn't actually say anything of much substance about what the substantive rules are for when the government wants to take your property or issue a fine or a fee or a court cost.
I see. So it's just about the amount, and it's at kind of at the high end. It's not at the end that affects all these people who get caught up in the system.
Not only that, but the case itself didn't even talk about the high amounts.
Uh-huh.
All the case in the Supreme Court was about was whether this Eighth Amendment should apply to the states.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the amounts of money at stake here. I know that when one appears in traffic court, one very striking thing about traffic court is that for people who appear, it'll be something like speeding, it'll be suspended license or expired license, as you've described. And those fines are typically, as in my observation, they seem to be a few hundred dollars. I think for someone who's well off, it's an annoyance. But one thing that's very striking is that when people are in court, it's pretty clear from looking and talking, you know, listening to the stories of the people in court, it's more than an annoyance for these people. And so what happens is that you're describing, it seems to me, something that's a pretty big burden that they can get out of control. So can we talk about that?
Yeah, I've spent the last 5 years of my life working on these cases in courts all over the country and spent a lot of time observing a lot of these low-level courts. And we've filed major federal class action legal challenges to these fines and fees systems in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Missouri. Our case in Ferguson, for example, has perhaps gotten the most attention. When we got to Ferguson, Ferguson averaged 3.6 arrest warrants per household. Think about that. 2.2 arrest warrants for every adult in the city. And what does that mean when ever you leave your house, you know you could be arrested by the police because you have an outstanding warrant? The vast majority, almost all of the warrants, were for unpaid debt to the city. Ferguson, like many jurisdictions around the country, had converted its local police and court system into a tool of revenue generation. And they ruthlessly exploited the black community in Ferguson to generate that revenue.
And how much is that was used to run the city of Ferguson or to run the police department? Like, was there financial pressure because of a tax-based problem, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so a couple of things are going on. One is that they had become so desensitized to the brutality of putting chains on people and throwing them in these cages that they did it for very, very flimsy reasons, including to generate revenue. And two, as you mentioned, the city needed it for money. So they were funding large percentages of their city budget off of these fines and fees. And the internal emails that they have suggest that. They say, we have to start arresting more people so that we can generate more money for ourselves. I mean, they were very open about it in all of their internal emails. So I think, take a step back. You know, when I first got into this, I remember the day very clearly. I had just started my organization. I was investigating.
This is Civil Rights Corps or the earlier organization?
The earlier organization.
Equal Justice Under Law.
Yes. And it was my first sort of few weeks as a civil rights lawyer. I went down to Alabama and I went from court to court and I just started watching. And every court I went to, judges were throwing people in jail just because they were too poor to pay fees. The entire debt collection system had been privatized to what we call a private probation company. And this company, the way it worked was if you got a ticket like you mentioned, let's say a $100 ticket, and you were too poor to pay that ticket right away, you'd be put on probation with this company. The only purpose of the probation was to collect the fee. So, but they charged you an extra 40, 30, 40 bucks a month. So after the first month, let's say all you could pay was $15 that month because you were on food stamps and you were living in pretty abject poverty. Now, in month two, you owe $115. You owe your original $100 plus the $30 monthly fee, but you paid 15 of that. And that's not even including all the money they charge people for the drug testing and other things that they attach to this probation. So, you know, I saw person after person who had been on this probation for 2, 3, 4 years. And even though their original ticket was $100, they'd been jailed 5 or 6 times and they now owed $1,000 because all the fees and fines added up. And it trapped these people in these perpetual cycles.
So this sounds a lot like indentured servitude and other spirals that people get into.
Exactly. If you read the well-known great book called Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman, the Wall Street Journal reporter, he describes how in the wake of slavery, a lot of the southern states, particularly Alabama, which is the one he was focused on in his research, reproduced a lot of the same conditions through a system of convict leasing, that is, using the criminal punishment system to trap people in a cycle of forced labor. When I got to Montgomery, Alabama, the first morning I flew there in 2014, I walked into the local courtroom and I sat down in the back. There were 67 people on the docket that day in jail jumpsuits and chains. Not one of them was accused of a crime. They were all there because they owed unpaid traffic tickets to the city of Montgomery. They were all thrown in jail. I went and interviewed them in jail. You know, I'll never forget these interviews. The first person I interviewed was a young mother who'd been sitting on her couch with a 4-year-old next to her and her 1-year-old on her lap. The police raided her home. They arrested her, took her children out of her arms. She'd been in jail for a couple of weeks. She did not know where her children were. She owed traffic tickets from 2010. And as she showed me her court document, it said, pay us $2,807 or sit 59 days in jail. And so she turned over her court document and she had a pencil and she was writing the days 1 through 59. And each day she was writing 50, 50, 50, 75, 75, 75, and asked her what these numbers meant. She said, well, I'm trying to calculate how much money I'm working off each day to pay my debt so I can figure out where my children are. And it turns out in Montgomery in 2014, if you just sat there in the jail, you got $50 a day toward your debt. But if you agreed to be a janitor for the city and to clean the dirt and the mold and the urine from the judges' chambers and the jailhouse floors and the walls, you got an extra $25 a day. So they had this army of indentured servants, debtors to the city of Montgomery, who were janitorial staff for the jail. And so, you know, by the time she finished this description to me, her tears had smudged all of her pencil calculations, and she was trying to desperately figure out, you know, how many more days it was. And so we filed a federal civil rights lawsuit on her behalf. And, you know, within a few weeks, the federal judge ordered all of the top city officials to appear in front of him and explain how this could be happening in the city of Montgomery. I mean, after all, it's been unconstitutional for decades in this country to put a human being in a jail cell just because she can't make a payment. And something very interesting happened. Instead of coming to court and justifying what they had done, they just released everybody from the jail. And this has been a theme that I've seen throughout my short 5 years doing this kind of work. We've become so desensitized to the brutality of what we're doing that we stop requiring good reasons for it.
Did no one challenge them on this in the past? Is this why they just did that?
Right. Nobody's challenged this in most jurisdictions around the country. It's happening everywhere.
And now what's happening in Montgomery, Alabama? Have they gone back to that, or the state now?
We entered into a federal consent decree that stopped them from doing this ever again. And so for a period of 3 years, if they ever tried to jail someone, they had to call my personal cell phone. I think what's remarkable about this
I guess it's good that we've been sitting here for a little while and your phone hasn't rung.
That's right. But I think the scary thing, right, is that Montgomery had such bad reasons for putting so many people in jail away from their families that they, without any concern about quote-unquote public safety, they could just release everybody, right? And one of the pillars of our work now all over the country, and we've reproduced this case in numerous jurisdictions. We just won the similar case in New Orleans and in Mississippi and in Ferguson and Jennings, Missouri, where we brought these cases, and Tennessee, where we won a $14.3 million settlement in a RICO extortion case that we brought against a private probation company in Rutherford County, Tennessee. I can talk about any of these cases, but the main point is that these public safety rationales that you started off with have no connection to what the legal system is actually doing. It's actually being used as a tool of revenue generation.
And these all these places you've mentioned are in the Deep South, or in the South rather, but that's not always the case. So, for instance, you've done work on money bail, and some of that is in states that are not Southern. There's a high profile case in California. Can we talk a little bit about the money bail system work that Civil Rights Corps has done?
Yes. So, as we were doing these debtors' prison cases and vindicating this legal principle that nobody should be put in a jail cell because she's poor, we started thinking, this same fundamental constitutional flaw is at the very core of the American money bail system, except that the only difference is that in the money bail system, you're innocent until proven guilty. So you're being thrown in a jail cell prior to any even conviction just because you're poor. And when I first started telling people that we were going to challenge this, people were laughing at us. They said, well, we use the money bail system in all 50 states and 3,000 jurisdictions all over the country. You know, it's ubiquitous. How can something so ubiquitous be unconstitutional? And that's the mentality, right? This basic legal principle, which really accords with all of our own moral values, that we shouldn't be caging someone because she's poor, is being violated every single day by every single public defender, judge, and prosecutor working in every single jurisdiction in the country, with very few exceptions.
And when you win these cases, do you win under state law or federal law?
We've been bringing our cases under federal law, and we've been making a very simple set of arguments. We've been making arguments under what we call the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And the arguments are related. The Equal Protection argument is basically that it's unfair to treat two similarly situated people so differently by putting one in the jail cell and allowing one to go home to her family when the only difference between them is how much money they have in their wallet. And the Due Process Clause is connected to that, and it says it violates the basic fundamental right to liberty, to bodily liberty, that's been at the core of our constitutional tradition for hundreds of years, to put someone in a jail cell without having a really good reason for doing it. And what's happening all over the country with the money bail system is we're jailing people because they're poor, not because of any assertion that they pose some danger to the community or some risk of flight. And so we've brought money bail cases all over the country, from Chicago to California. We've been involved in money bail litigation throughout the South, as you mentioned, in Massachusetts, and virtually as many places as we can go as a small organization.
And how have you done in these cases?
We've done very well. So we've had enormous success, partially because when we get into court and the other side has to come and justify what they've been doing, they're not able to do it. And
is there justification? We've always done it this way. Is that the justification, or is there deeper justification?
There really aren't very many justifications. I mean, when we – perhaps the most significant case that we've done that got the most national attention was the case in Harris County, Texas, which is the city of Houston metropolitan area. And that case was really the first case to put the American money bail system on trial. We had an 8-day trial in front of a very well-respected federal court judge, Chief Judge Lee Rosenthal, and she's one of the most highly regarded federal judges in the country. She evaluated hundreds of thousands of records. Expert witnesses from both sides flew in from around the country. We did statistical analysis of the Harris County system. We evaluated system as it was operating in Harris County.
And she's Chief Judge of the District Court for the Southern District of Texas, and she's a George H.W. Bush appointee.
Correct.
Okay, this is interesting. All right, keep on going.
Much of our success, by the way, and this is not a partisan issue. I mean,
that's why I'm
much of our success around the judge in Alabama who ruled for us was a George W. Bush appointee. Much of our success comes not from judges of one political party. And in fact, if you look at the mass incarceration bureaucracy around the country, it was largely built by Democrats. Democrats have had control of most of the local large urban jurisdictions in this country. They've built the local police forces. Many of the judges that we're dealing with, the prosecutors, they're all Democrats. So this is not a partisan issue. We've had enormous success with a lot of conservative judges as well who believe very strongly in the limited role of government and human liberty. We've also had success with liberal judges who believe in those same values and also who are appalled at the racial and economic injustice that pervades our criminal punishment system. And Houston is a really good example because prior to filing our lawsuit, there were 50,000 misdemeanor arrests every single year just in Harris County. 20,000 of those people were kept in jail for the entire duration of their case just because they couldn't afford a couple hundred dollars. Now, after we won that case and we got new rules put in place, we're going to save about 19 or 20,000 human beings from jail every single year.
And have these cases been appealed to higher courts? Like, how high has it gone in the federal court system?
So these cases are currently on appeal. The cases are on appeal in the middle federal court, what they call the federal appellate courts. So the next stage from that would be the Supreme Court.
Hopefully, do you think they're going to take it?
I would hope so. I mean, this is an issue of enormous national urgency, and the basic legal principles that are relatively uncontroversial are being violated every single day in courtrooms all over the country, to the point where right now, as you and I are sitting here talking, there are about 400,000 human beings sitting in jail cells because they can't make a monetary payment prior to being convicted. The California case you mentioned is perhaps the other most important case. We won a case called Humphrey on behalf of a man named Kenneth Humphrey, in which the California Court of Appeal struck down the operation of the California's money bail system as we know it. That case is now on appeal in the California Supreme Court, and we're waiting for the court to set oral argument.
I see. Now, just to make sure I understand this, so do you imagine then, if it's as you say, that it's not a clear, there's not a clear partisan divide, do you imagine that maybe this will end up going to the Supreme Court, finding that money bail is a 14th Amendment violation?
I think that the Supreme Court will rule in our favor on this case. I mean, I think that the legal principles are so clear and the level of injustice is so intolerable. They won't hold that money bail is a 14th Amendment violation. What they will hold is that putting someone in jail just because they can't pay a money bail is unconstitutional unless you have a much more rigorous set of processes. So, for example, you can't just announce an amount of money, like $5,000, $2,000, $300, $100, and if the person happens to be able to afford it, they get out. If they can't afford it, they stay in jail. That process is unconstitutional. But the court will tolerate financial conditions of release for people that can afford it. So, for example, if Bill Gates is arrested and they give him a $500 money bail and he can pay it, he gets out of jail. There's nothing unconstitutional about requiring him to pay some money. As a matter of policy, I think it's silly. There's no evidence at all that money bail serves any purpose. Like, it doesn't actually even encourage people to come back to court. But as a matter of constitutional law, I think the Supreme Court will allow there to be money bail. It just won't allow people to be in jail just because they can't pay it. The core of our case to the Supreme Court and the argument that I think the Supreme Court will accept because it's so well-founded in American legal history is that if you are going to keep someone in jail prior to trial, it has to be because you've made some finding that the person is so dangerous or such a risk of flight, and there's no other alternatives that we can do short of jailing the person. So we've tried all these other things. It won't work to have them, you know, report to a pretrial services officer. It won't work to have them get some treatment for maybe a drug addiction issue. It won't work to take away their passport. You know, the judge has to make findings that there's all these other available mechanisms. None of those work, so we have to resort to the last resort of jailing the person. And if and I think where the state of constitutional law is right now is if you do a hearing and you show that there's a real need to detain this person, then you can detain the person prior to trial. But it should be the carefully limited exception.
Now, it's been said in the wake of the Humphrey decision, I've seen news reports claiming that it's very well to do away with jailing people because they can't make bail, but that the replacement is a system of assessing risk of whether that person should be allowed to walk free. And the claim is that that system itself can be biased and itself can contain hidden biases that then still put some socioeconomic classes at risk compared with others. So what do you say to that?
The punishment bureaucrats who created the money bail system are trying very hard to replace that system with something that will reproduce the same outcomes. You can see the same thing all across our legal system.
So you mean the same income outcomes, the same revenue outcomes? What do you mean by
same? Total outcomes. So both. So for example, so you know, this is an uncontroversial point around the rest of the legal system. So for example, you can have a legal case like Brown versus Board of Education, which says, you know, you can't segregate schools. But 60 years after Brown, you can have more school segregation on some metrics than you had before Brown in some jurisdictions and in most jurisdictions, because if you don't address the underlying structural problems, a legal victory won't actually do much. So that we're seeing the same kind of thing in the bail system. We can have a legal ruling that says the money bail system is unconstitutional and has to change, but the same forces that created the money bail system are going to be looking for a way to reproduce those same outcomes. What do I mean by that? Well, the main function of the money bail system and the reason why it's developed the way that it has is twofold. First, because this bureaucracy is arresting and trying to throw in jail so many more people than any other society in the recorded history of modern democracies has tried to do, it needs to develop mechanisms to be really efficient. It needs to have a sort of mass assembly line process. And so the way to do that is to coerce people to plead guilty, because there's no way that our legal system could have enough lawyers, enough judges, and enough time actually enough people coming in for juries to have jury trials for everyone accused of crimes. So what do? We have the plea bargaining system. And the reason that money bail has flourished is that everybody knows that if you're stuck in jail because you can't pay money bail, you're going to plead guilty much more quickly to get out of jail. So in that Houston example I gave you, if you couldn't pay $200 or $100 to get out of jail, those 20,000 people I'm telling you about, they pled guilty, and they pled guilty in an average median of 3.2 days. Their cases were over virtually as soon as they got started. But the people who could afford to pay, and those people, by the way, they pled guilty 84% of the time. So almost all of them are pleading guilty and pleading guilty in a few days. But the people who could afford to get out, their cases last 112 days. They got lawyers. They fought their cases. More than half of them never got convicted at all. And so think about what that would mean for the rest of the legal system if you didn't have the money bail system sweeping up millions of people and then coercing them to plead guilty very quickly. It would blow up the entire legal system. So keep that in mind. The reason for the money bail system coercing guilty pleas quickly. The second reason is the for-profit bail bond industry. It became a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry to charge people for their release.
But the way you're describing it, that's almost secondary in the sense that it arose in response to this other means of making the system more efficient from the point of view of someone who's administering the system.
Correct. I think
so. I was ready to believe that it was all driven by money, but now I'm getting the idea that money is a thing that arose in response to it because there were flows of money in a system that was attempting to be more efficient.
Correct. I think as the system metastasized, there became more and more ability to make profit at every single stage, including the for-profit bail aspect of it. I think, but you're right. The main evil here is the need of the bureaucracy to function efficiently. And so because it's trying to accomplish so much more than any other legal system has ever tried to accomplish. And so I think the for-profit bail industry gets a bad rap. It gets a lot of the negative press attention. But I actually think that it's the functionaries and the criminal punishment bureaucrats that created the money bail system and that are still in charge and are trying to now determine what follows it. And that the California example is perfect. So keep in mind that what I mentioned is the two main functions of the main drivers of the money bail system. So that leads to, what are the punishment bureaucrats now proposing to replace the money bail system? They're proposing an increased system of pretrial detention without money bond, because they want people in jail, so they coerce them to plead guilty. And they're proposing a system of non-financial conditions of release. But all over the country, the same people that were your bail bond agent are now converting their business model into, they want to be the person that sells you the electronic monitoring device, that sells you the drug test, that you pay to supervise you. So they're making just as much, if not more, money in just a slightly different way. And so what we're doing is we're leaving the money bail system behind, but a lot of jurisdictions are trying to move into a system of detaining most of the people without money bond, just straight up detaining them. And then the people that they're releasing, they're making money off of them through surveillance and control of their lives, through various forms of pretrial monitoring.
What kind of things can be done? You're describing a system that where the incentives are set up in a way to drive these officials who are working in the system to create these rules that trap people. What can be done to improve the state of the whole system, whether it be public defenders or legal reforms? I mean, you're one organization, and my guess is it's a little hard for you to file lawsuits in thousands of jurisdictions. So what kinds of things can be done at state, federal, and local levels?
I think there are really three things that we should all be focusing on. The first and by far most important is the number one way to make the criminal punishment system better is to shrink it. You should oppose any reform that results in more resources going into policing and prosecution and jailing. That is not the way to solve the social problems that we have in this country that are connected to poverty and education and race and healthcare.
So you're saying just reducing the burden of prosecutions that don't do any good for society. So for instance, just to pick an example, marijuana legalization. If you decriminalize marijuana, then that leads to fewer arrests in that category in a crime that appears to not, in some ways, not touch people.
Not only does it lead to fewer arrests, but it has so many ancillary benefits that flow from it. It reduces the number of people at which someone can make a profit at every subsequent stage of the system. It makes the dockets for public defenders, prosecutors, and judges smaller so that more attention, individual attention, can be given to other types of cases within the system. It reduces jail and prison overcrowding, which then decreases violence and infectious disease and all the problems that we see in jails and prisons. It decreases the number of people with criminal convictions on their record who are having trouble getting housing and employment and healthcare access when they get out. So the more people that you put into the beginning of the system, the more it causes problems at every subsequent stage of the system. So the number one reform is ratchet down the number of people that we're putting into the system.
What are categories of offenses where either prosecutorial discretion or law enforcement discretion or laws being passed? Are there offenses that ought to be either turned into not offenses or de-emphasized?
Well, I don't think that the criminal punishment system is a way of dealing with any kind of social harm. So for me personally, I don't think that the way to a society with less sexual assault or less murder is by spending extraordinary resources on caging people who commit those offenses. There's absolutely no evidence in the scientific record to support that point. And so from my perspective, I don't like to talk about it in terms of offenses. I understand that's a controversial view. So I think what we could do as a start is just agree to bracket, let's say, all of the very serious offenses where someone has done incredible bodily harm to someone else. And just say, let's not talk about that small percentage of the criminal legal system. Let's talk about the other 90, 95% of the criminal legal system, which is virtually useless. It's no evidence that it's doing anyone any good.
Okay, so this is what I'm getting at. I guess what I'm getting at is, let's say you're trying to persuade someone who doesn't see this the way you do. Let's say, you see what I'm getting at?
Sure.
So it's like, let's say, I mean, speaking of someone who reads technical literature, I am A-okay with the argument you just made. However, there is the question of persuading people who don't see it this way. Maybe I'm reaching for something like a cost-effectiveness argument where, you know, it costs us a lot of money to administer the system, and if we ratcheted that down, the state government would save money or something like that. I'm looking for some kind of arguments that would bring enough people around. And, you know, maybe your argument would work well in, say, a liberal state, but I'm trying to figure out how this turns into reforms that materially improve people's well-being. How does one get enough people on board to go along with this improvement to how we deal with social issues?
Yeah, I think that happily, all of the empirical evidence is on our side. And I think we have a very, very important battle to wage to demonstrate for people that every dollar you spend on affordable housing, and health care and mental health treatment and drug addiction treatment saves many, many dollars as, in terms of overall social well-being. Whereas every dollar you spend on law enforcement, so-called law enforcement or policing and caging people, actually decreases overall social well-being. And so I think it's a matter of explaining to people that if you care about, let's say, home burglaries or retail theft or drug addiction or trespassing or all of the main crimes that are really taking up the bulk of the criminal legal system, the way to a society where those things are happening less is actually taking those dollars and spending them on things like healthcare and mental health treatment and affordable housing. And all of the evidence suggests that that is a far better way to address those problems than punishing and caging people and taking them away from their families. What we need to be doing is expending resources and strengthening those families and strengthening the connection to the community and helping people have safe shelter where they and their families can survive. And so I don't think it's that hard of an argument, and I think we're seeing it being made all over the country. The real goal and the real difficult task ahead of us is that the people who've run the criminal punishment system have a lot of power, and they have dominated the cultural narrative for decades. And so our task as advocates and as people who care about these issues is to have a little bit of a different conversation, to lift up the stories of the people who are affected by this, and to organize people to shift that balance of power so that communities are getting the solutions that they need to be more holistic and so that they are getting the resources they need for a more holistic conception of well-being.
Well, this has been very interesting, and I'm pleased that we're able to end on what I would say a relatively hopeful and forward-looking note. I just wanted to remind people that we've been talking with Alec Karakatsanis, who's founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps. And I forgot to mention at the beginning earlier that Alec is writing a book called Usual Cruelty, Complicity of Lawyers in the Mass Human Caging System. And this is going to be coming out in fall 2019 under the New Press. And I guess you'll be addressing some of these issues in that book.
I hope so, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is another episode of Politics and Polls. I'm Sam Wong. I'm your host. And if you're interested in us, you can rate us and subscribe to Politics and Polls on iTunes. And if you're interested, you can ask Julian Zelizer and me questions on our email address. The email address is politicspolls@princeton.edu. That's politicspolls, P-O-L-L-S, at princeton.edu. Alec, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WUcast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.